Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimpera, host of the Public Policy Channel, and we are joined today by Ian Tyrrell. Ian is the author of American Exceptionalism, A New History of an Old Idea from University of Chicago Press. Ian, welcome. If you would, start us off by telling us a little bit about who you are and what it is that brought you to this particular book.
Thank you, Stephen. It's very good to be with you. I am an Australian-born and bred historian of the United States. I lived in the United States for a total of about 6 years, and I do think I know the country reasonably well. I became interested in American history at a very early age. The United States has been a big influence on Australia since the Second World War. So growing up in the 1950s, I watched quite a few American movies, including the sort of Davy Crockett type movie. So I was fascinated by American history from a very early age. And when I went on to become a historian, I decided to specialize in American history. And I think it was because, obviously, of the great importance of the United States in the world. And that was what I wanted to find out about. And I wanted to find out about what was going on in America in the 1960s, although my own graduate work didn't start until 1970. Since that time, I've, you know, specialized in quite a lot of different things, moving on from the history of social movements onto other things. But whenever I embarked on a new research project, I found myself coming back to the question of what was different about the United States and was it exceptional? By the 1980s, these thoughts began to clarify in my mind. In 1991, I wrote an article on this topic in the American Historical Review. I turned back to my specialized research interests, but I kept finding American exceptionalism popping up. So when I finally retired in 2012, I decided to devote the next few years to looking at that topic. And that's what brings me to American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism was becoming a topic of considerable discussion in the United States, which actually it had not been when I wrote my first article in 1991. It was something well known to historians and political scientists. Personally, I read and was influenced by Seymour Martin Lipset, for example, who pioneered in the academic world the use of this concept and name for it. When Barack Obama was elected, he made a speech on American exceptionalism, or American exceptionalism came up in the speech. And he appeared to contradict the doctrine of American exceptionalism. A closer examination of the speech suggests that wasn't the case. But anyway, the Republican Party took this up and they began to talk about Obama as an enemy of American exceptionalism. And they eventually made this an important part of the campaign to unseat him at the 2012 presidential election. In fact, the topic American exceptionalism became a whole chapter in the Republican Party platform. The idea of exceptionalism went from a purely or largely academic idea to one which had a broader resonance, at least in the community of readers and viewers on television and the internet. So it was about that time that I started to get really interested in writing a book about it, and that's when I discovered that I really actually didn't know a lot about it. I needed to do a lot more research. I managed to get an Australian Research Council grant, which helped with some research assistance. And I just went on with it for there. And I was amazed by what I discovered. Some of the things were very well known, but a lot of them weren't. And that was how I came to the topic.
So recognizing, of course, that American exceptionalism is literally the topic of the entire book, for folks who may not be familiar with the notion, if you will just tell us in very brief terms what it is that most people tend to mean by American exceptionalism, and then we can look at the way in which it has been understood and deployed in a few key moments throughout U.S. history. So what are we talking about here when we talk about American exceptionalism?
We are talking about the idea that the United States is actually a unique country with a history which is unique and which is in the minds of most people who talk about this idea, superior in its approach to things than other countries. The United States can certainly make mistakes, but those mistakes are all seen within this pattern of the United States having this sort of special role in history. And that idea really goes back to a religious one, an idea of the United States as a chosen country or a chosen nation that appears at various times in American history, particularly in the early days, particularly it goes back to the Puritan period and the concept of the city on a hill that John Winthrop used in 1630 in Massachusetts. But just more generally suffused through the population by the 1830s, 1840s. So that it was sort of the original idea. Now over time, the idea that the United States has been chosen by God is no longer heard so much, but in fact it is still a prominent idea within the broader kind of spectrum of ideas about American exceptionalism. And even people who perhaps don't believe in God or just certainly don't think that God, directs the United States in a certain way through providence, these people still think that their nation is somehow chosen. And this is a very difficult concept to deal with because it's essentially impossible to disprove. It's an assertion. It's a belief. And I began to realize that American exceptionalism was fundamentally about belief. It was about the belief in a country, not so much in the facts about that country. Long before the era of fake news, I think this was true. No matter what you do to show that there are similarities to other countries, it's very difficult to shake the concept of the United States as exceptional in the way that I've mentioned. Now, there is another entirely different, or apparently entirely different, approach to the topic, and that is to say, well, let's look at all of the different characteristics that there are about American society or American politics, and let's compare them to other countries. And comparison is a great thing to do because it does show a broader worldview. And how does the United States stack up against this? Now, this is particularly prominent in the social sciences in the post-World War II period, and the idea was to try to look at these differences or similarities with other countries and see what they added up to. And almost invariably, they seemed to add up to the idea that the United States was radically different. But it was a political sociologist named Seymour Martin Lipset who began to use the term American exceptionalism to describe this phenomenon of the United States being radically different and sort of off the plane of other countries. Now, Lipset was a very prominent person. He was president of the American Sociological Association and the American Political Science Association, and he taught at many of the best universities in the country, such as Harvard and Columbia, Stanford, and so on. So he, University of California, Berkeley. So he was very, very prominent in this idea, and he went on researching it for many years on and off. A bit like me, though, in the sense that he kept coming back to it while he was doing other things. Now, so his idea was that you looked at these differences between the United States and selected other countries, and then saw just how different the United States was overall from these other countries. But the difficulty is actually leaping from the particularities of certain things. It might be, for example, the voting system, for example, to similar kinds of things. And leaping from that to a generalized idea that the nation is exceptional is a virtually impossible one to actually carry out as a social science project. But it didn't stop people from trying, and it did spread the idea that the United States was different. So when we look around, we can see many, many things about the United States that are different. We saw in the COVID issue, for example, that the United States seemed to have inadequate response to COVID than some other countries. But it also had a more adequate response than in many other countries. So you could see it as being exceptional because of what it did do on COVID or what it didn't do on COVID. Now, when you start to get into that realm, you realize that you're not really dealing with a strong and rigorous pattern of social science observation. You really, in order to establish that the United States is exceptional in an empirical sense, you need to look at a series of characteristics and compare them to all other countries. And that is a very difficult thing to do. So generally, it doesn't work out that it can't be proven that it's exceptional. What it can be proven easily from observation is that the United States is, got, for example, the largest military in the world. There's no doubt about that it has enormous military power. Its military spending is far greater than the next dozen or so countries, I think. So it's different in that way. But does that mean exceptional? Because what is the actual characteristic underlying this military spending that you need to look at? Is that this sense of it being chosen, for example? Is it a sense of its commitment to democracy? What is it that you're looking at? So Lipset actually had a lot of trouble coming to a kind of clear point on that. I think that's so what
there's,
I was
saying. There's obviously, and you point to this at some great length in the book, right? There's a real tension between this sort of Lipsetian effort to quantify the distinctiveness of the United States, the ways in which it does and does not differ from other nations and particularly other rich democracies. But that's hard to reconcile, right, with that with Winthropian ideal, right, the city upon the hill, the distinctly moral vision. I wonder if we could bounce back to some of that history, because I think one of the things that struck me as interesting is you suggest that in that pre-revolutionary period, this notion of exceptionalism, largely religiously rooted, is about our moral distinctiveness and our virtue. But by the time we are in the midst of the revolutionary period and the constitution building period immediately after, we are also now adopting this in order to think of ourselves as politically distinctive as well, that somehow we've also latched onto political virtues that haven't been discovered. Can you talk a little bit about what you see going on in that period? And then I want to jump forward and talk a little bit about anti-exceptionalism ideas, maybe in the Civil War period. But talk to us a little about the revolutionary era and the political distinctiveness and where that comes from.
Well, the idea of the revolution from Britain was a enormous break, and it was a really important point in world history. I think the thing to think about is whether it was part of a chain of events, or is it situated in something broader, or is it something that is kind of outside of that movement. Now, American exceptionalists tend to think of the revolution as unique and to kind of isolate it from the events of world history, except to say that, of course, it provided an example to the rest of the world. But there were many, many other things going on around that time which underlay what happened in the United States. And, from an empirical point of view, the United States was still, in 1789, a relatively unimportant country. And it didn't have the kind of, hefty influence, for example, that France had. And the French Revolution I would argue at the time, had a bigger influence internationally, although later on, of course, the United States has vastly surpassed that. But the idea of American exceptionalism is that the United States was unique from the beginning. So, it's a question, not that it was became unique later on, but it was exceptional from the beginning. And that there's a difference there between the what I think was the more common idea at the time was the revolution and the ideas of republicanism and so on, and to some extent a little bit later on democracy. They were at the foundation of what constituted American exceptionalism. But on the other hand, there was that religious idea, and the two tended to blend in during the revolutionary period. Many of the people who were supporters of the revolution really wanted to have religious freedom. And I think the concept of religious freedom, separation of church and state, etc., is so foundational to American exceptionalism at the time, because it seemed to be different from Europe. In Europe, the established church, which basically meant the Catholic Church in most cases, had a considerable power, although that was greatly damaged by the French Revolution. The United States just appeared to be a beacon to the rest of the world that religious freedom was the way to go. And many people who supported American exceptionalism saw exceptionalism as a way to achieve their goals of, you know, spreading their religious doctrines and just practicing their faith. It became an enormous anchoring point for American exceptionalism. But it's been misinterpreted, though, by more recent generations. The idea of the city on a hill was the concept that's often used to describe all of this. But the city on a hill idea, as historians, before I wrote, have established, was a very didn't have the significance at the time as a document that it subsequently has had. It's a document which has been drawn into politics since the Reagan era to kind of nail on the masthead what American exceptionalism actually stood for. But it didn't have the prominence before that. But the more generalized idea of a chosen nation was one which was widely accepted, even by people who weren't religious. They would say that the United States was a chosen country. Somehow it was chosen, but the position of providence or religion, if you like, or role of God within this, differed, you know, from one person to another, from being a direct intervention to being just something which was in the background.
And even today, there are people who treat the U.S. Constitution as if it were a religious document, right? As if it were this immaculate thing handed down from God, creating this brilliant, perfect architecture for a political system.
Yeah, I know.
As a political scientist, I can tell you it's rather absurd when you see its actual machinations.
It is absurd when you see the machinations. And historians have drawn attention to this. But the idea of it as a sacred document has been, propagated by many people, and it's found a lot in the architecture, if you like, of civil religion. In the very fact that the Declaration of Independence was, in a glass case down at National Archives, for example. One, I don't know whether it's still there, but
I think so.
And it's a sort of venerable document in the way that other people might take sacred scripture. So, political scientists and others did write about this idea of a civil religion. The United States adopted a civil religion rather than an actual Christian Christianity. Although obviously Christianity was what they mostly meant was what was behind it. The position in the Constitution and in the amendments, the first 10 amendments, was one of independence between church and state. It wasn't meant to try to turn people away from religion, but to just give freedom to choose. And these ideas of freedom of religion and freedom more generally are ones that Americans have grown up with, and it's been inculcated in them. It's inculcated in them in schools. It was seen in the 19th century all around them in the 4th of July celebrations, where there would be long orations about this, in the pulpits, addresses, and sermons, particularly by Protestant clergy. and so on and so forth, those sorts of things. And then, you know, even more recently, it's sort of it kind of been enshrined in the environment through all the monuments that kind of are raised around the to venerate the founding fathers and, you know, just how exceptional they were.
So this takes, I think, sort of fascinating form in what you refer to as sort of early instances of anti-exceptionalism. I'm thinking of your writing about anti-slavery Jeremiads. Can you talk a little bit about how does that fit into the way in which this idea plays out?
Well, the idea of the Jeremiad is that the people have forsaken God, and it was a Puritan idea. The people of New England in particular, and the Protestant churches more generally thereafter, were aware of this concept. And it certainly was a very powerful concept, because it pointed the finger at people, and particularly at the people. The people as a whole were failing God for various reasons. And as far as the abolitionists were concerned, for a lot of them, it was because of slavery that they were failing God. So this led to the excoriation of slavery and of Christians who supported slavery, of which, of course, there were many. The idea of the Jeremiad was a really powerful critique of American exceptionalism in a way, but it was also within the exceptionalist tradition, because the Jeremiad always said that if you could come back to God and you could repent of your sins and you could sort of take up the American cause of democracy and freedom and liberty where you'd left off, if you just got rid of these sins, the sins in particular at that time were centered around the issue of slavery in the first half of the 19th century through to 1865. So there are lots of critiques of slavery, and many of these, but by no means all of them, did come from this position of the Jeremiad. Now, when Sek van Berkovich, the late Harvard literary scholar, popularized this idea of the American Jeremiad, he did say, and it was only in a footnote, that there must come a point when the people are so sinful that the Jeremiad no longer operates to return people to American exceptionalism. But he, of course, was unable to say what that point would be. Just where is it that Americans have diverged so much from their founding ideals that they can no longer have a hope of exceptionalism? And he thought that there had to be that possibility. And some anti-slavery people did take that course, and others who weren't of strongly evangelical Christian background did too. The United States had simply gone beyond the pale. That obviously tended to be a minority tradition, but that was part of the anti-exceptionalism of the anti-slavery movement, I would argue.
What strikes me as particularly interesting in this moment, thinking back upon that period, is because as the way that you talk about how people understood that moment, that it was right, that slavery was the aberration, that we had strayed from the path, we had moved away from the noble vision that God had ordained for the nation. We had sinned, we had moved away, but we could return back to our status by returning back to our course. And of course, there's lots of people today who would argue that, well, no, that's exactly wrong. Slavery was, in fact, the essence of what it meant to be an American, and as many people have talked about it, right, our original sin that many would argue today we have still not resolved and come to terms with. How do you see sort of that the tension of those kinds of ideas playing out, either in contemporary history or in other periods?
Well, I wouldn't use the language of original sin myself, but I can see why people would argue this. I mean, the issue of slavery and the race problems, which, you know, in considerable part emerged from it, obviously is as the abolitionists understood, it was an incredible blot upon any idea of the United States as this shining democracy. How could you possibly argue that the United States was, as you know, Lipset did, was such a you know, wonderful democratic country if they not only allowed slavery, but slavery was actually kind of embedded in the Constitution, and it was, you know, defended to the death. Now, from Lipset's point of view, this was a blot on the American character, which had to be overcome. And in fact, Lipset, like Tocqueville long before him, saw the race issue as being the one that the United States really had to come to terms with if it was ever going to achieve its noble goals. But the psychological, I suppose it is, value of that approach to looking at the topic as, you know, it's a sin that we have to overcome, and it's a kind of a single aberration, is that everything else about the United States is okay. It's that one fundamental or original sin. I mean, I would personally argue that the seizing of land from indigenous people was in many ways an equal sin, because it involved taking people's land in a world in which land was their spiritual and cultural essence. To take the land away from people was to destroy them, or to attempt to destroy them as a culture. And so for me, from the very beginning, there is an original sin, and it's actually the seizure of land. But of course, it's a sin which is was committed also by other European peoples. It was by no means a purely American aberration, as it were. This is why the comparative history of slavery is so very important, and we can see just where the United States fits into that. But if we start to think it in purely American terms as an aberration from this noble purpose, we're just not getting where the United States is and was within the contours of world history.
So let's jump far forward now, and talk a little bit about, we've talked about Winthrop and the city on the hill. Let's talk a little bit about Reagan and what he calls the shining city on a hill. And then maybe if you would, as we work our way toward concluding, lead us from Reagan up into how you think about the Trump era.
Ronald Reagan was obviously a tremendous communicator, and he had an ability to touch people, I think, through his voice as much as anything else. He was originally a radio broadcaster, before he was a film star. We know that this idea of the city on a hill was just not a very prominent idea, even within American exceptionalism, which, as I've kind of implied before, was being led in the 1950s by a kind of a social science project to work out what were the empirical differences between the United States and presumably all other countries. And that, of course, was something which was problematic in itself, as I've indicated before. But this idea of the city on a hill actually came partly from the work that Perry Miller, the Harvard intellectual historian, did in sort of resurrecting the study of the Puritans and the discovery of the intricacies of their arguments. And he kind of laid the groundwork for, he didn't do this deliberately. He was not a present-centered historian, really, but he laid the groundwork for the taking up of this idea, first of all, by people around John F. Kennedy, and it was Kennedy who used this idea in a speech before the Massachusetts General Court in 1960, just before he entered the White House. So it was being put forward there as a very noble idea of the ambition of the United States to be the city on the hill. And from there, it passed through a variety of political sources on to Ronald Reagan. So the idea started out, if you want to put it this way, I mean, it had been a democratic political idea. It was an idea of John Kennedy's to take this idea of the historian Perry Miller via Kennedy's advisors and speechwriters into a serious place within a conversation about what the direction of and the moral compass of the United States was in the Cold War. When Reagan came along, he sort of dumbed that down into the shining city on a hill, which of course doesn't have a basis in the John Winthrop speech. John Winthrop wasn't thinking about how great the United States was. And the sort of fuzzy ideas in the shining city on a hill idea remind me of Norman Vincent Peale and the sort of, power of positive thinking. And that had quite an influence on Reagan. So what Reagan was doing was giving a feel-good version of the old chosen nation idea. No longer was it associated with the Jeremiad, where, you know, if you didn't watch out, you were going to fall and, you know, fall away from God's purpose. And it was something in which the United States was self-evidently exceptional. Reagan didn't use the term exceptional because it was still a largely academic term. It wasn't really until after his time that it became a major term to describe this. From Reagan, we get the downfall of the Soviet Union and the, you know, the idea that the United States had won the Cold War and that a unipolar world had developed after that in which the United States stood alone. And this really encouraged American exceptionalist thought. It encouraged it because as long as the Soviet Union was there as a kind of powerful adversary, the United States always had in the back of the mind that there was another country which also had a messianic idea for the future of the world and which was you know, attempting to modernize at that time and was a competitor in much of the underdeveloped world for influence. When the Soviet Union collapsed, then that was gone, and the United States was clearly number one. And from that point on, the idea kind of solidified, the idea of American exceptionalism kind of solidified. And that's actually when my own work came in, but I wasn't really thinking about that at all. When I was writing on when I was thinking about the topic in the 1980s, I wasn't aware of the possible downfall of the Soviet Union, for example. And I was in the background of this issue academically in the 1990s. I didn't take it on as a research project then. What did happen, of course, was that in the 1990s, the United States became called the indispensable nation. That was a phrase used by Madeleine Albright. Now, she didn't invent that phrase. It can trace it back to Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, but the way she elaborated on it did suggest very strongly a very strong view in America of American exceptionalism. She said the United States could see further than other countries. So the impression is given that the United States had a special vision, that it was above the rest. It could see into the future, that it was embodying the idea of American exceptionalism as beyond history, as outside of history, outside of normal history. Because under the chosenist doctrine, the United States is outside of that normal path of history. It's chosen by God. It's following God's path rather than following the path of interactions with other nations. And when Bush came in, he began to use the chosenness idea more than in the past, and but it still didn't catch on really until the time of to call it American exceptionalism until the time of Barack Obama. Now, Trump was an interesting put an interesting new light on exceptionalism. That, in my opinion, Trump was not dumb. Trump is not dumb. That's just my personal opinion. I don't think he's a dumb guy at all. I think he immediately saw that American exceptionalism was being used as a kind of a rhetoric of national patriotism at a time when American soldiers were dying abroad and when American influence in the abroad seemed to be declining during the time of George W. Bush and thereafter. Trump was asked, you know, well, what do you think about American exceptionalism? Of course, he said, I don't like the idea. I don't like the term. So, and that was the kind of sort of radical twist that Trump was able to put upon things at times that galvanize discussion. And you know, he was asked, but you know, why are you saddling up to Russia? You know, Putin's a killer. He's an evil guy. He's a killer. And of course, Trump said, don't you think we've got killers? Trump was pointing out that the United States had been involved in a lot of untoward things during the Iraq War, but also much earlier in the Cold War. And the United States was not, you know, free of sin, as it were. So Trump sort of touched a nerve with that. But Behind him, the Republican Party still remained exceptional. What Trump said was that America was great. He said he wanted to restore America's greatness. He wanted to make America great again. Now, that idea actually was an idea that was first used by, as far as we know, by Ronald Reagan. And Trump used it without an acknowledgement. But Trump took that to be his campaign, which was about greatness. And I would argue that exceptionalism is not about greatness, because greatness is a quantitative standard. The United States has the greatest army in the world, but that doesn't make it exceptional. Exceptionalism has to revolve around ideas of, is the United States a special nation chosen in some way to effect the cause of republicanism and democracy around the world? And Trump clearly wasn't talking about that. He was talking about repairing the damage that this unipolar world and the foreign policy vision of it within the United States was bringing to the American people as he saw it. Now, from my point of view, he's a pretty strange person to be put up as the cheerleader or the leader, you know, the spear thrower for the opponents of this new world order. But he did strike a chord, and that's where his critique of American exceptionalism came from. But surrounding him, American exceptionalism just wasn't really budging. The idea of American exceptionalism remained pretty much rock solid within the Republican Party.
This is the New Books Network, and you've been listening to Ian Tyrrell talk about his new book, American Exceptionalism, A New History of an Old Idea, from the University of Chicago Press. Ian, thank you so very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Stephen. It's my pleasure.